Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hi. And welcome to the special podcast series from These Football Times called The Political Football. Football is a global phenomenon. People who follow it can fall into an obsessive mindset where victory or defeat for their national or even club team can define their lives, attitudes and understanding of the world around them, both locally and globally. Over time, and in so many places around the world though, the game's ability to intoxicate and elicit an unquestioning devotion to a cause has often been manipulated by states, parties, other political organisations, or indeed individuals seeking a way to persuade, influence and increase power by using football as a political tool. This series looks at a few examples of such scenarios, considers their context, cause and effect, and how the game has been used by such political forces. It also questions whether at times football has kicked back against these forces or provides a means to counter them. This is The Political Football, and today we'll be looking at FIFA, Blatter and the House of Avalanche. I'm Gary Thacker, and I'm delighted to be co-hosting this series with my good friend Stu Horsfield, who's going to have a slightly different role tonight. But how you doing, Stu?
Yeah, good, thank you. I feel like a bit of an interloper on this one. It's the one I've been looking forward to more than any other in this series.
Yeah. So who's our guest, buddy?
So today our guest is Stephen Scragg. Stephen's a senior writer with These Football Times and has appeared a number of times on other editions of the Lob podcasts. He co-hosted the World Cup series along with Jim Hart, and a font of knowledge on international, all things football, in fact. Obviously, he was an ideal guest for us to get onto this series. In fact, he's so good, we've had him on twice. He's bookended the series for us. Obviously, this episode of the football, political football, brings our opening series to a close. Like I just said, Steve's bookended both. But I believe, Gary, plans are afoot to launch Series 2 in the not-too-distant future.
They certainly are, buddy. Yeah, we've got... we're taking a break after the end of this one. But as you say, we've got plans in place and already we've got a number of submissions and all the slots are already filled. So we'll take a break and set things up and then we'll be picking up again.
Brilliant. So as we're bringing the curtain down then, we've decided to take a step back, like you said, Gary, for a wider perspective. Look at FIFA and the various machinations that the global organisation running the game has experienced, together with sometimes less than savoury shenanigans of some of its hierarchy, which is quite a polite way of putting it. Like you said, we're going to be discussing FIFA, Blatter and the House of Avalanche. Steve's particular interest in this subject is the House of Cards effect. His view that FIFA had to fall at some point, and it was and still is, it's fascinating to see it implode and attempt to regenerate itself despite the looming spectre of what I'm sure Stephen will talk about in detail, its greatest folly, Qatar 2022.
How are you doing, Steve?
We're doing well, thanks, Gary. How are we doing?
Great, mate. Looking forward to this. It's great to have you on board.
So I think it's a fine way to finish what's been a brilliant series.
Yeah, thanks very much, mate. We've certainly enjoyed it. Before we go away, and I mentioned this, referred to this before, introduced Stu, that the subject of tonight's chat is something Stu has particular interest in and knowledge of. So I'm going to leave much of the discussions to Steve and him. I've just pulled myself a beer, and aside from chipping in occasionally, I mean, you have to have some. We didn't listen to a football chat, and beer is important. So aside from chipping in occasionally and asking a few of the questions, you'll hear an awful lot less from me than usual. I'm sure that'll be a blessing. And so I'll leave the discussion to most of these two guys. So just to kick it off, though, Steve, just give us a little bit of a political context of how you see FIFA, and particularly with regard to the House of Avalanche and the House of Cards.
Sure. Well, FIFA's just been a monster, basically. It grew from a humble beginning, and it just snowballed, really. You know, even up to the mid-1970s, it was still, a bureaucratic office in Switzerland, basically. It wasn't anything like the shiny and laminated product that it is now. And it all changed in 1974 on the eve of the World Cup, when there was the presidency was contested. And it was actually... it wasn't a scheduled vote as such. This was more of a peaceful coup almost. Haviland went up against Stanley Rouse, who was a critical and controversial figure himself, and Haviland won. He took the wider perspective of the world. The football at the time was still quite the international game, a very narrow channel. You know, the World Cup batted back and forth between Europe and the Americas, and there was very little scope for the rest of the world to gatecrash that party. African sides had boycotted in 66, and the door wasn't really open, you know, and Haviland swept to power on a ticket of saying that he would open that door, he would kick that door in, and to an extent he did, but, you know, a lot more went through that door than just Haviland.
Sure. Stu, would you want to add about context, mate?
Yeah, it's, like Stephen said, you look at FIFA, and essentially for over half a century, you had essentially just three different personalities running essentially the most powerful sort of sporting organisation in the world. You know, with Stanley Rouse, with Haviland, and then Sepp Blatter. And you know, I'm not sure how good it is for any organisation to have that amount, just three people over such a prolonged period of time. It, you know, it almost stifles it, and it's a
sense of dictatorship.
Absolutely.
You know, even the Soviet regime changed hands more often.
it's true. You know, it's right. And obviously, what you ended up with, and you know, and Stephen has alluded to it, Stanley Rouse really was. He was sort of a part of the past, you know. He was very much a colonial man. It was all about amateurism. He was about sport and politics not mixing. You know, he was very much, you know, believed that football and politics should be kept separate, which, you know, as time progressed, you know, turned out to be incredibly naive of him, and obviously allowed Haviland to almost take power in, you know, in a peaceful coup, as Steve sort of mentioned. But it was almost his political naivety that opened the door for Haviland. Certainly the whole arena of Africa was so greatly misunderstood by Rouse and so well understood by Haviland that it allowed Haviland essentially to take power based on the African vote. And it's funny because Haviland had actually warned Rouse of the potential for almost a coup based on the African vote, because at the time, you know, Haviland had mentioned to Rouse that we have a one nation, one vote policy whereby Spain or Germany or Italy or England or Argentina and Brazil, you know, their vote counted just as much as Egypt or Sudan, you know, and if ever the African continent and certainly Asia as well mobilised itself, there was that potential for a coup. And because of his colonial background and sense of imperialism, I don't think Rouse ever saw it coming, or that somebody would organise them, or that they would vote against him. And I think that's sort of to his detriment with regards to how he lost power in 74.
Right. Yeah, very, very much. I mean, even to the last minute, you know, in the days leading up to a... you know, the vote was too close to call in many respects, and some outlets felt that Rouse was going to win.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, I mean, I'm sure we'll come on to it later on. I know Haviland's sort of relationship with Hearst Dassler with regards to the early days of the money-making machine of FIFA. Hearst Dassler believed that Rouse would win and was already sort of making agreements with Rouse about how to take FIFA and football forward. And then as soon as Rouse lost, and you know, Dassler moved on to Haviland, and you know, and so history was setting itself up. But yeah, like you say, Stephen, even at the time it was such a close vote, and you know, I don't think they really believed. I certainly don't, Europe definitely didn't believe that Rouse would lose that 74 election.
No, it was expected. The very English phrase of a bloody nose was expected, a close call. But no, Rouse was expected to win amongst the Europeans, and there was a defined old world versus new world, you know, decision to be made there, even down to kind of like just a few hours earlier, Colombia being, you know, allotted the 1986 World Cup. You know, that couldn't have happened under Haviland. That would not have just wouldn't have happened. you know, giving Colombia the World Cup was akin to kind of like giving it. It was like Chile hosting it in 1962. Colombia could have hosted the 1962 World Cup, but there was no way it would be able to host the 1986 World Cup. So that World Cup, that Colombia 86 World Cup, was killed within 24 hours of it being handed to them, because it was handed to them by Rouse, basically, and they were unopposed in that vote as well. There was no other alternative to Colombia. It was just stated that, you know, it was the America's turn in 1986, and there were no viable alternatives. And when Colombia stepped forward, they basically entered an empty field and you know, picked it up just because they were there. But then, you know, within 24 hours, Havelange is in charge, and it's you know, although it took, what, 6 years for them to eventually admit defeat in hosting the 1986 World Cup, it was dead in the water straight away.
Yeah, I mean, it was almost like, and again, I'm sure we'll come on to it, like with Havelange's promise of expansion to the African nations in return for the votes. Colombia was never going to be in a situation to host a 24-team tournament.
No. There was no way they could do it. I mean, even up to the 1982 World Cup, and the 1982 World Cup final, up in the rafters, there were billboards, Colombia 86. They were still the official hosts at the 1982 World Cup. They were still officially the next host of the World Cup. And when FIFA asked categorically, in person, to the delegates that were there from Colombia, are you hosting the 1986 World Cup or not? They said, well, that depends if it's going back to a 16-team World Cup, and that was never gonna happen. I mean, on taking the job, on taking the title from Rouse, he immediately tried to extend the 1978 World Cup to a 20-team tournament, and it was only that attempt failed, but then he eventually increased the World Cup for 1982 to 24 teams. It was never going to go back to 16 teams from there. And but Colombia was dead in the water straight away. But that it's just that kind of complete... It's just like a tectonic plate. It's a shift in a tectonic plate, basically. It went from the old world to the new world. In the blink of an eye.
I think you're right. I mean, that meeting in that 1974 meeting in Frankfurt, when, you know, when people talk about when did football change, and we talk about it here in 92 and the advent, you know, there's football before the Premier League and then football after the Premier League, but you want to pinpoint a moment in time in football, and it's that Congress meeting, yep, that in 1974 in Frankfurt, that was the birth of modern football as we know it now, and it's completely, and certainly a FIFA. It is
that's where FIFA changes completely. And you know, as a beast, you know, it's, I don't think it's even waking up to itself in 1974.
No,
it's only kind of from getting past the awkward World Cup of 1978 that the penny drops on over just what they have in their hands within the sport of football and what they are capable of milking from it.
Yeah, it's funny because I think the media magnates and the sponsorship magnates, and we talk about Patrick Nally and Hirst Dassler. I think they knew. I just, like you say, it took a while for football to fully understand what it had.
You had various visionaries, but they were seen as P.T. Barnum. They weren't, you know, it wasn't across the board that was believed or bought into. It was one or two individuals, and then eventually that tilting of the balance changed and everyone bought into it.
Listening to you two guys talking about 1974, and obviously this is such a massive change of emphasis at FIFA, I guess, you know, given the fact it's best part of 50 years ago now, there'll be a lot of people listening. Well, I hope there'll be a lot of people listening. Perhaps you won't. I hope there's at least some people listening. And I'm sure a lot of them will sort of not be aware of these events. And it's fascinating listening to you know, talk about how this massive change came about between the old and the new world. And so do you think that this was a sort of a political and financial, political and nationalist, political and personal, or was it sort of a combination of all those things with Havelange launching this new world?
I think for me, I think the world was shifting. I think I think it was almost... I think Rouse was a victim of circumstance and a victim of the times. And I think Havelange was very much of the new modern world. Havelange was very much of the old world. And the world itself was ready to move on. I mean, you look at South Africa and the problems that exist in South Africa. And again, Rouse's attitude towards it was very much that FASA, which was the Football Association of South Africa, was in place when he came to power. Now, they were very much a segregated football association. It was either all black teams, all white teams. There was no mixed teams. There was no white teams playing against black teams. And then the South African Soccer Federation set up to try and counteract what FASA had in place, and they set up in order to represent what was essentially 80% of the South African population, the mixed race, and the black people, and they tried to vie to be the recognised Football Association of South Africa, and eventually got to a stage where Rouse took a delegation out, and he saw this new association that was challenging FASA as actually they were trying to do it for political gain. They were doing it to try and widen their sort of political motivation, if you like, with regards to apartheid, and actually decided to recognise the Football Association of South Africa, and as such, Africa as a continent would termed that as that FIFA and Rouse in particular was inherently racist, and so it's almost Rouse sort of was caught up in this changing world, even though I would imagine deep down he believed he was right, and it was, I don't want a member association where there's a political motivation behind it as well. I want a member association that's all about the football, but he couldn't see that the world was changing and that he needed to change and that FIFA needed to change. Stephen will say in a minute, but for me, I think he was a victim of a changing world.
Gotcha. What do you say, Steve?
Yeah, I agree there. Yeah, I mean, he wasn't perfect by any means, Rouse. You know, he fudged Africa badly. I fully agree with absolutely everything Stuart said there. You know, he was a victim of circumstance. He was, you know, the old man in a like walking into a nightclub, basically, by 1974. He was completely out of sync with the shift in sands, basically. And Havelange just took advantage of that spectacularly.
Yeah, so it's case probably the world had moved on and Rouse and the FIFA of Rouse hadn't noticed the train leaving the station then?
No, that's right. And the fact that, you know, Havelange was basically intimating that from a distance. You know, for him to step in, I do believe that, you know, he stepped in for the right reasons initially, and circumstance warped that eventually for Havelange and his dubious political offspring. And he did. I do believe he did it for the right reasons. And there's an element of Rouse about within Rouse as well. I mean, and that's probably why the two of them saw eye to eye for as long as they did. You know, Rouse and Havelange. You know, they were bedfellows for a long time. And you know, it was a frustration that led Havelange into the decision that he made to challenge for the presidency and eventually win it. And I think the intentions were noble to begin with, but you know, once you've got the golden egg, it's what someone does with it is a completely different matter.
Yeah, they're so power corrupts, don't they? And absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And obviously, they had absolute power in FIFA. Do you think the sort of money coming into the game at that time, especially in the World Game, the World Cup, sort of accelerated that situation?
Yeah. I think it was more the horizon that they were watching at that time. You know, the 1974 World Cup, if you look back, you can look back at quite a bit of the footage of those World Cups. You know, there were huge empty stands in a lot of them. Particularly Mexico 86. You know, there was a lot of... You know, there were certain games, like obviously the England-Argentina game, that had like 108,000 or whatever it was, which was absolutely, you know, off the scale. But there were plenty of other games where the, you know, the stadiums were lucky, you know, if you were lucky, were half full. But yeah, I think the vibrancy of Spain 82 kind of took them by surprise. I think the evocative images of Argentina 78 also probably it was a slow realization of just how big it could be. But 86 was like the big one, really, because with the USA, kind of like they tried to kind of like take the host candidature. When it came back up for election, for the bidding process to replace Colombia, the USA tried to go for it. But at the time, it was the NASL, and the NASL, you know, the propagators of the NASL did not see eye to eye with FIFA. You know, the great quote from, I think it's Clive Toy, who said, "You can't kick the door of FIFA relentlessly for a decade and expect them to open it and let you walk in." And that was why they didn't get 86. But the USA had everything in place for the 86 World Cup. The infrastructure, they had, you know, all the transportation, they had the stadia, they had everything to make the 1986 World Cup a massive one. And whether that would have meant that the NASL would have survived is another matter. But I think there was that reluctance to give it to them, and the fact that Havelange had come to agreements with certain elements of the Mexican congregation is that eventually a lot of the promises that were made and the predictions that were made that were seen to be unbelievable with regards to what the USA felt they could deliver for 1986 were eventually, by 1988, it was kind of like realised, no, actually, they could. Because the 1984 Olympics, the football competition, the stadiums were full. All the stadiums were full, and it was probably the greatest football, Olympic football tournament in modern history. And that just opened FIFA's eyes. It opened Havelange's eyes. You know, all the scepticism of everything that they were told would be the case for a USA 86 World Cup suddenly looked very, very real. Hence, in 1988, they get the 1994 World Cup. And it's from that moment on, you could probably say the 1984 Olympics was the one that really, really kind of like set the cash tills ringing at FIFA.
That's really interesting, actually, the sort of link between the Olympics and that sort of, as they opened the door for the cash cow that the World Cup became.
It is. I don't believe there is no coincidence there. You know, it is. You know, and I've known other people, you know, say that themselves, that they looked on the 1984 Olympics and the way that they handled the football tournament and the way the crowds flocked to the games. It was very much a view of, look at that. And then they looked at their own World Cup 2 years later in Mexico, which we all love as a you know, an aesthetically pleasing World Cup. But I think they looked at the 1986 World Cup compared to the 1984 Olympic tournament and thought, actually, just look at what it could have been. And hence, yeah, by 88, they've been given their own World Cup.
Yeah, fascinating that obviously the World Cup was born of the Olympic tournament back in the 20s, and then, you know, here we are 60 years.
Yeah, there is a striking kind of like similarity, really.
Yeah, Stu.
Yeah, there's a few things there. I mean, Stephen's absolutely. I mean, one thing you've got to look at is that media and media technology was developing rapidly and at a pace. So images beamed back around the world were becoming more accessible. The thirst for colour television, football, you know, was starting to drive. The momentum was starting to drive as well. So you had a developing technology that allowed for tournaments to be televised and to be shown on a global scale, you know, in colour. And I mean, the 82 World Cup is just, obviously looking back at it as a kid, and I know Steve and I chat about this all the time, but it was visually for me, the best World Cup I've ever seen. TV gets better, and there's HD and 4, whatever it's called, 4K, and all the things that go with it. But I still remember the 82 World Cup and the colour and the vibe that almost came through the screen. And like you say, you know, FIFA cottoned on to that, and you come to that bidding process, like you said, Stephen. And I mean, really, that was a stitch up before it even started. I mean, America had, you know, they'd a 90-minute presentation. Henry Kissinger had gone, the Secretary of State for America. You had, you know, they had over 100-page document, and the Mexicans went in with somewhere between an 8 and 10-page pamphlet, depending on whose book you read. And we're in and out in 10 minutes, champagne in the conference room, and America hadn't even started.
They were popping the corks before the American delegation went in to see them.
Yeah, and you look at Los Angeles Olympics, and at the time there, the head of the IOC was Juan Antonio Samaranch, and the head of the IAAF, and the World Athletics Championships had just started then as well. I think it's 83 is the first one.
83, yeah.
And Primo Nebbiolo. And there's a great book, and it's called Lord of the Rings. And it's about Samaranch, Nebbiolo, and Havelange. And the three of them were all presidents of their organisations. And the three of them just took global sport and their global competitions and just made them these massive worldwide televisual events that sponsors, that marketeers, marketing companies, PR companies wanted to be involved in. And like you say, you know, it comes from that Los Angeles, from the dour, boycotted Moscow Olympics that visually wasn't great, to all of a sudden this glamour and sunshine of Los Angeles, you know, and the Coca-Cola was everywhere, and you know, McDonald's was, you know, and all of a sudden you had these companies wanting to be a part of that on a global scale, and Samaranch, Nebbiolo, and Havelange were the perfect people to take advantage, you know, of the, like we said again, the ever-changing world that it was at that time.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you suddenly get, you know, these blue chip companies queuing up to you know, hand FIFA, you know, money. Basically, it's, you know, the license to print money, you know, was there from 1984 onwards. And, you know, whether there was a regret within FIFA that they didn't, you know, they weren't bold enough to give the Americans the World Cup in 86 or not, you know, they corrected that amongst themselves.
Yeah.
You know, for 1994, but I mean that's the whole insanity of that as well, is that despite the fact that the World Cup has, you know, increased in numbers to 32, you know, that 1994 World Cup remains the most attended World Cup ever. You know, the last 24-team World Cup, you know, less games than they have now, you know, but still, you know, it is the most attended World Cup. And when it goes back in 2026, it'll break records that will probably never be beaten.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think, sorry, I know we're later on the point. I'm sorry, Gary. I think
you mentioned
it briefly, Steve. If FIFA had football's best interests at heart, I would argue America needed the 86 World Cup. Whether long term it would have survived, but at that time, it was crucial.
It is one of football's greatest what ifs, you know.
Yeah.
Those ponderables, you know, it's the sliding doors effect. What if, you know, just what if? Because, you know, especially those close calls that were very, very, you know, kind of like knife edge, toss of a coin, and that's one of them. You know, the NASL, you know, floundered not long after the decision to take the 1986 World Cup to Mexico was made. You know, had it gone to the States, had they known a World Cup was coming in 1986, then the NASL would have had some kind of boost. You know, would America now have, you know, the biggest league, club league in the world, rather than the much lamented MLS?
Yeah.
You know, what would the club landscape, what would the world landscape, you know, have been now had Mexico 86 being USA 86.
And again, you can look at that with the national team as well. I mean, there's, you know, in a country of over 300 million, there's got to be 11 decent players.
The potential development of the sport there. And I mean, yeah, it's, you know, maybe it wouldn't have made an impression, a long-term impression, but, you know, we'll never know that now.
No.
I want to bring it up to Dayton shortly. I'm really fascinated to hear the conversation about the with the competition between America and Mexico to pick up that World Cup tournament. And I guess people now wouldn't perhaps be overly surprised to hear that there were sort of behind-the-hand conversation and backdoor agreements, and regardless of how good or bad any presentation was, the deal was already settled before they walked through the door. But, you know, perhaps they might be a little bit surprised to hear that was, you know, this is nothing new. This was going on back in, you know, back 30, 40 years ago.
Oh, completely. I mean, it goes back, you know, to 1966 almost, you know, as well, because, you know, at the time that England are hosting the World Cup, you know, agreements were made between nations to step aside for certain World Cups so another would host and they would stay out of it. So, for instance, it was agreed in 1966 between Germany and Spain over which World Cups to go for. So that kind of, like, subterfuge, you know, has always been there. But that 1986, you know, decision was, you know, it's like the committee that went to inspect, you know, the grounds and the stadiums and the infrastructure of each nation for the World Cup in 1986. They went to Mexico. They didn't go to the USA. They didn't go to Canada, who also, you know, put a bid in. And that's the intriguing thing now for 1986, is that Mexico, USA and Canada all went for it, and they will together host the 2026 World Cup. You know, the way that the world turns, the way that football turns and goes full circle, is stunning. You know, 40 years will stretch between the 1986 World Cup and the 2026 World Cup, you know, from them all fighting over one to coming together to host one. You know, it's amazing how things change.
It is. There's a really good book, I think it's by David Yallop, How They Stole the Game. And he talks about Havelange's personal dislike of Henry Kissinger based on his physical entry into a FIFA guest's box that Havelange happened to be in at the time. And in his gregarious American manner, Havelange felt that he sort of took over the sort of the FIFA guest and delegate box. And from there on, the personal dislike was actually one of, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why Havelange was determined that America wouldn't win that vote in 86.
And within one swoop, you know, Havelange's, you know, his reason for being FIFA president changes.
Yeah.
You know, it goes from, you know, rather than expansion and bringing the World Cup and the sport to different parts of the world, suddenly it's a personal nature. And, you know, it's brought in kind of like advocates of Havelange when he was, you know, in his bid to become president in 1974. You know, it's now that Havelange is scratching the backs of those who helped him to get into that position. You know, he inherited the 1978 and 1982 World Cups. And in 86 was effectively, although it had been given to Colombia, the fact that they weren't going to host it, this was his first World Cup, really. This was the first World Cup directed under his leadership to who and where it would be hosted. And there was no vote. Havelange directed the FIFA delegation to accept the Mexican vote. There was no vote on that second bid for the 1986 World Cup.
I think as well with that became, and you mentioned it really well, or you quoted it really well at the beginning, Gary, I think that's where he realised the absolute power that Havelange actually had over the game and over nations, I mean, powerful nations like America, who were bidding to host his tournament, his event, and all of a sudden, you know, and there's like I said, there's books, there's been some fantastic stuff done by authors, you know, and Havelange's self-opinion is almost, you know, he sees himself as an equal to heads of state, you know, he sees himself as... You know, I mean, football, people view football as a religion and, you know, with the Pope as the head of the Catholic religion, you know, and he puts himself on a par with these world leaders, these iconic figures, you know, in the world. And that's it. That's how he sees himself.
By the time you get to Blatter, he supersedes that even.
Yeah.
You know, I can remember, you know, an interview in which he stated that, you know, he gets to walk into nations that, you know, the US president can't. You know, every door is open to the FIFA, the president of FIFA. You know, there are no doors that are closed. You know, everyone shakes his hand.
Yeah.
You know, and you could just see the look in his eye as he was saying this as well. It was just this sense of self-satisfaction and, you know, realization of the power that he wielded. And, you know... And when someone wants something off somebody like that, it's such a elusive target to aim for, and it became a dangerous. And this is where it became more of a dictatorship than a presidency.
Well, and obviously, I mean, even luckily, America only keep their presidents for 8 years as a maximum.
Exactly.
I'm hoping this one's only got four, but that's a different subject.
Yeah, this is something FIFA really should be doing.
It absolutely is. I mean, it's something that, you know, Infantino, if he's truly honest about how FIFA can progress and move forward, there's lots of things they can do. But I mean, that's an incredibly simple fix. Is a two-term maximum. Period for a president.
Exactly.
It's interesting there, Stu, that you use the phrase "truly honest" in relation to FIFA and the hierarchy there. strange bedfellows at times. It's interesting you mentioned Blatter. So I just want to sort of bring it more up today because I mean this is fascinating, but we could sort of get sort of stuck in the Havelange era. So let's move it forward a bit and let's talk about money. I mean, here's a contentious statement, so knock it down or applaud it or wear it up the flagpole and see who salutes. FIFA's now basically a money-making organisation that uses football to achieve their financial ends.
For me, FIFA will always argue that they... I mean, now they have multiple tournaments. You have under-17s, under-19s, you know, Women's World Cup, Confederations Cup. But FIFA always argued that they had one tournament every 4 years to make their money. You know, and that was it. And that was always their get-out-of-jail card, if you like, for how much money they were making. You know, they argued that they had very little money-making potential. Certainly, you know, obviously with Rouse and Havelange, but, you know, as Havelange started to bring in the extra tournaments, Blatter continued that. But with the massive amounts of television money, you know, with the negotiations now of the corporate capitalist world that we all live in now and that FIFA exists in, it's, you know, that argument of, well, we only have our tournaments, you know, for me is out the window. That's, you know, it has a corporate responsibility for the money it makes, and I don't think they fully... I don't think they fully accept their moral responsibility with regards to the money they make. How they make it, so long as it's legal, which, again, I highly doubt, but some of it. But how they make their money is up to them as an organisation. When you are making such vast amounts of money off a large percentage of the population of the world for the world's game that they are essentially a custodian of, I'm not sure that they are truly... living up to their, like I say, their moral looking after, if you like, of the game of football. I don't.
Yes. Steve?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Stuart says there. I mean, for me, there is a front of shop now, you know, under Infantino, is that, you know, for everything that's now gone under the bridge with Blatter, Infantino's come in. and there is this attempt to be more even-handed in a visual manner, at the very least. Behind the scenes, it will not have changed in the slightest. But that concept of, you know, irregularities, very glaring irregularities, like Russia getting the World Cup, you know, you might have got away with that one had Australia or China or the USA been allotted the 2022 World Cup. But Qatar, you know, was peak FIFA. You know, that doesn't get any more peak FIFA.
Yeah.
And you know, you could turn around and say, all right, well, Russia, fair enough, to say on the same day, almost in the same sentence, the same breath, Russia, Qatar, you know, is absolutely mind-blowing. Even now, after all these years, it is absolutely mind-blowing. But now what you've got is, you know, a FIFA that will try and make public sense. We will try and make visual sense. And that's why USA, Mexico and Canada will co-host the 2026 World Cup. That's why I believe that, you know, England will host the 2030 World Cup in some manner, whether that's as a collective with the rest of the British Isles or on their own. I think that will happen. If they can't find a way of getting Uruguay and Argentina to do it, then it'll come to England.
Yeah, okay. We'll come back to Qatar in a bit, but just sort of before we sort of move on to Qatar and Russia and the World Cups that and how they've been allocated recently, I just want to say, because of the political influence of finance and power, are there any national teams or clubs that have a greater sway in things? I'm particularly thinking that I saw on the news today that Infantino is flouting the idea of having a World Club Championship every year now, and where that sort of giving clubs, and especially in the Premier League, obviously money rules, and I just wonder whether that sort of increased influence for certain clubs or national FAs might have an undue and unhealthy influence on FIFA. What do you think?
I don't think any nation on their own can stand up to FIFA. I think the only thing you can have with FIFA is that, you know, you might get to a point where, you know, UEFA have the ultimate standoff with them. You know, UEFA has a lot of power. You know, there's nothing saying that at some point further down the line they do the ultimate and withdraw and say, look, we will have our own game. We will run European football and withdraw from FIFA and float their own ship. And they could do that. You know, we already have a 24-team European Championship. You know, why not extend it to 32 teams and invite the 8 highest-ranked non-European teams to take part in it? You know, you've always had, you know, the Copa America, where they have 10 nations and invite 2 non-CONMEBOL nations. You know, there is a precedent for it that they could point to. You know, I just don't think that any one nation on its own can do it, but a confederation could, and there's no confederation, a singular confederation, big enough and powerful enough than FIFA to be able to do something like that.
Yeah,
but that's the thing. It just depends on how far FIFA push UEFA. You know, the concept of a World Club Cup does not sit well with UEFA. And there's talk of that being possibly an annual event. It'll come to a standoff eventually. It's just whether or not FIFA can placate UEFA, and they'll feel that it's almost like they're testing the boundaries with these kind of initiatives, for the want of a better word.
Yeah,
Stu? Yeah, Stephen's absolutely right. I think FIFA need UEFA more than UEFA need FIFA is how I would say that.
I don't think UEFA need FIFA.
No, I think they've got, for me, they have the, whether I agree with the format it is at the moment, but I think they have the greatest club competition in the world. Like Stephen said, they've got a 24-nation international tournament. I mean, UEFA are set. You know, they don't need They don't need FIFA. A World Cup without European sides would be incredibly damaging to FIFA. A World Club Championship that didn't have any UEFA club sides in it would be meaningless. It would hold no value in the eyes of the rest of the world. And that's not being detrimental to South American sides, you know, or African sides, or Asian and Australasian sides, but you know, Stephen's right. UEFA is becoming more and more powerful as a confederation, and FIFA, in a standoff, FIFA would need to be very, very careful with how far they pushed UEFA, because they don't really need them.
Can you just sort of take it sort of to more sort of prosaic terms? And I mean, obviously, I'm not sure which one you mentioned the word custodian, but that's the exact word I was going to use with relation to the rules of the game, the laws of the game. Because ultimately that lies with FIFA. And if there ever was a split between UEFA and FIFA, I mean, I'm not sure how that would work, because it almost couldn't get back together again if they took different rules. It's a bit like when rugby league split from rugby union. It was one common game, and then because of different approaches, then it split. And you'd have things like VAR. I'm not sure if they had that split, how that could actually work. I mean, UEFA would be, I guess, locking itself inside its own ivory tower. What do you think about that?
I think football's, I mean, the rugby split, you know, at the turn of the sort of the 20th century, you know, I think, it was different times. You know, rugby league is very much, you know, and Steve and I both live in rugby league heartlands. You know, it became a very much a localised sport, rugby league. Whereas was rugby union, you know, was played, you know, in the rest of the country. I think eventually, I don't think both sports have thrived, but certainly both sports survived, and rugby league to a certain extent has survived probably better than most would. But that's possibly due to the fact that was a professional nature. But I'm not sure how much the game would change if UEFA withdrew itself from FIFA. I mean, football is a very simple game, and that's part of the beauty of it. But I'm not sure what else could be brought in that would change it that dramatically, he says. I've been seeing the backpass rule introduced and all sorts, and level is on, or interfering, not interfering's on, and all the things that they do. But I think both would, for me, both would be foolish to change the game on an individual basis to suit their organisation.
Yeah, I wouldn't see that happening myself. I think what had happened was the status quo would remain. You know, both sets of parties would come up with their own bright ideas, of which, you know, the other would possibly watch for a year or two and think, well, that actually works. We'll implement our own version of that. So I think the two strands of the sport would remain similar-ish, you know, because, I mean, you have differences in the club game across Europe as it is. You know, Italy uses VAR, England doesn't. You know, eventually the two tend to overlap. You know, they diverge, but they come back together again, and, you know, a consensus would eventually be, you know, would be arrived at.
Yeah. Time's always our enemy on these things, but I just want to sort of bring it up to date and talk about the well, get you guys to talk about awarding the World Cup of to Russia, and then obviously 2022 and Qatar. And I wanted you to perhaps have a sort of consideration about why these things happened. Why did Qatar get it? Was it purely financial? Was it political muscle? Was it a combination of both?
Purely financial.
purely financial,
you know. And of course, there are political stepping stones to be navigated to reach that eventual scenario, but it's purely financial.
I think it's funny. I know I'm kicking into co-host. I'm kicking into co-host mode now. I'm really sorry, Gary. I apologise in advance.
I'll put you in two chairs. I know. So you can hop around between the two. I've got musical chairs.
Stephen, obviously, I mean, when FIFA fell, Do you think how much of the that awarding of the World Cup to Qatar and Russia, how much of that was the tipping point, you know, in your opinion, was the tipping point with regards to the end, the beginning of the end, if you like, for FIFA and certainly for Blatter?
Oh, it was the definitive end. You know, it was the point in time that all pretense was just dropped. It was almost as if FIFA was saying, look, you know what goes on. We know what goes on. Why should we bother pretending anymore? Qatar have got the World Cup. You know, it really was, you know, this kind of like, it was the drawing back of the curtain and saying, well, you've all guessed it anyway. Here we are. You know, it was the unveiling of the villain at the end of an episode of Scooby-Doo.
You know, pesky kids.
Pesky kids, yeah. But it was without the pesky kids, because they just weren't bothered. They thought they were unreproachable by then. You know, there was nothing they could do that would be challenged, that they were the law and they were untouchable. That was the full-on untouchable moment. That was the full-on, there is nothing you can do about this, and this is what we're doing. Okay. And then eventually, you know, eventually the FBI and the wonderful Andrew Jennings thought otherwise.
Yeah. I want to try to be really greedy and jam in two or three questions, well, probably three or four questions if I can each, so I don't know, time is running. So here's another statement to be discussed. FIFA is merely a parasite on the game. Discuss.
I agree.
Steve, I love your concise answers, mate. That's great.
I know we'll push for time. I'll go concise. Fully agree. Could football do without FIFA? You know, could another, you know, set of people do a better job than FIFA? Undoubtedly.
Okay.
Your quote that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I think football has become so big that to have a single entity, and I know you have Congress and delegates and committees and, you know, and all of these things, but ultimately, you know, there's a single figurehead who is in charge of what is, you know, a frighteningly huge and powerful, you know, organisation. And they're not governed by what seems to be the rules of the land. They, you know, they are a law unto themselves. And Stephen's right. They've been, you know, they've been reined in and reined back. And everyone's looking at Infantino, and they're trying to put on this front of yes, we're dealing with this, and we're very
and that's
much.
It. That's what they've done. All they've done is taken one step back to where they used to be, and that's kind of like the happy, smiley, outward face. But behind the scenes, it's just business as usual. I mean, Infantino sat there discussing, you know, God knows what with, you know, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, you know, while journalists are murdered, you know, in embassies in Istanbul. You know, it's morally corrupt.
And that was the thing. That was the thing, wasn't it, in the Guardian's story today, which you were talking about as well, Gary, with this new club championship. And I mean, and that was jumped all over, certainly by the Guardian today. That, like Stephen said, that's, you know, I think four times he's visited there, in, you know, relatively recently. And you've got to,
but you've got to ask why.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've got to ask why, yeah, and you've why? Got to ask what you're thinking.
Is that you know? Is that really to discuss the building of football stadia and getting kids to play football in Saudi Arabia, or is that to line the pockets of FIFA?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think I know the answer to this question because you've sort of broadly touched on it. You both broadly touched on it a few times. So Infantino, is he a new broom? Can he change FIFA for the better? Will he change FIFA for the better?
For he'll me, change FIFA, but yeah. go shoot.
Sorry, for me, I think, yes, people have moved on and people have been moved out, but I think, like Stephen said, the organisation is inherently corrupt, and it would take, it almost needed an independent person or even an independent body to go in and root out what was wrong with FIFA. They've put a football man in the football job, that you've replaced it with a slightly smilier, more palatable version of what already existed, you know, in the first place for me.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah. It'll make us, you know, statutory changes. You know, the World Cup is going to expand in teams. You know, the new tournaments will come in. It'll actually, you know, it'll escalate in the amount of games that are played, the amount of money that is made. You know, that old concept of, you know, what used to make football special and make it feel like an event was the fact that, you know, less was more. But, you know, it's, you know, so clearly more is less, isn't it? But he'll make his cosmetic changes, but behind the scenes, nothing changes.
Can I just...
You know, FIFA could have done with dismantling.
Yeah.
And replacing.
It's funny. Again, I'm so sorry, Gary. I feel so rude. I'm sorry.
No, please.
Stephen, what was your perception of Platini in the early days as a football politician to compared to how it ended? Did you see it ending like that, or did you believe in him?
I was hopeful rather than convinced.
Okay.
But yeah, I think what came home to roost for Platini was that when the bidding for Euro 2016 was taking place, and the French president was ushered into the chamber to speak to the delegation who would vote for the host nation, and Turkey, who were going head to head with them, weren't allowed the same. The same honour, basically. And when Platini was pushed on this by the Turkish contingency, he turned around with some flippant remark about when a Turkish man is in charge of UEFA, they'll be able to have that kind of influence themselves. And that just spoke volumes of a man that was heading towards FIFA at that time.
Yeah.
Okay, penultimate question then. And is it time for a new governing body? Could that happen? Could FIFA, or is FIFA's control of the game too tight? I'm just sort of picking up on what you guys were discussing earlier about UEFA. And could that be a force for change? Would it want to be a force for change?
I don't see FIFA, you know, crumbling. You know, it will remain there, maybe on the basis that no one else would possibly want to pick up the reins, to pick up the pieces. The only point in time I can see maybe happening is, like we've said, UEFA perhaps making the ultimate gesture at some point and just withdrawing from FIFA and playing their own, basically taking the ball home and saying we'll govern our own game. But beyond that, you know, I think if UEFA made that gesture at some point, then FIFA would seriously back down. You know, they'd do everything they could to maintain the status quo and hand you a... And if that was to happen, then, you know, maybe things would change, because it would be... For something like that to happen, UEFA to back down from that would have to be basically being offered, you know, a partnership in running the game, almost. And if that was to happen, then who knows, maybe things can change. But even then, that would be a political movement.
Yeah, I mean, it's a massive, you know, it's a massive thing, isn't it? It's, you know, the organisation, as we've chatted about, you know, we've sort of covered the best part of half a century and more. It's become such this huge capitalist entity that how do you even begin? There's so much vested interest with so many parties that probably outside of football that we have no clue about. So, you know, it's probably not even, you're not even dealing with FIFA's interests, and can you reduce FIFA's power? There'll be power behind the throne from areas outside of football.
Yeah.
And will they let it happen?
We're throwing up UEFA as a potential, you know, mate waiting a deal with FIFA or an alternative to FIFA, but UEFA, you know, they don't go without their own skeletons in their cupboards. So, you know, it's, you know, out of one fire into another, if that was to happen anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to come to the final question then, and the same question we always end the political football podcast with. So, can football exist in a political vacuum? Does the passion engendered by the game too easily lend itself to being a political tool? So, the question is the political football inevitable?
Me? Yeah, I think I've said before that, you know, if football can survive within the wind tunnel that is FIFA, it really can survive anywhere. You know, we all bought into the 2018 World Cup like big kids, and I know a lot of that was down to the fact that we did that podcast series and suddenly we all felt like we were 12 again, and it's great, but we all embraced that 2018 World Cup at these football times and loved it and enjoyed it. But does that make us as much part of the problem? Are we culpable? You know, we continue to massage the ego of FIFA, and on it goes for another 50 years.
Good point, Stu. That's David. Good point, Stu.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I've listened to all of these, Gary, and I've heard you ask this question over and over again, and I mentally rehearse my own answer every time. And now I'm on the spot. It's like, Stephen, as always, you know, he's right. We're almost a victim of our love for the game, and if football exists, and we've talked about it a lot tonight, in its own political environment. And it's an incredibly political environment that football exists in. But while we continue to love it and watch it and throw all in with it, it will continue to exist however it wants, because we'll always be there for it. You know, it's almost like a poorly relative. You know, we'll always be there for it, no matter how it behaves, what it does, how it acts. We will always be there to love it and nurse it and for it to exist.
I think it's a good point, and I guess, you know, football fans, football's like our femme fatale, isn't it? You know, it's an unrequited love. You know, it treats us terribly, it breaks our heart, but we still go back because we love it. So I mean, great guys. So, that's time to wrap it up, and I just want to say a massive thanks, Steve, for coming on to help us bring the curtain down on the series.
No problem. It was a joy as ever, and best of luck with the second series. I'm looking forward to hearing it.
Thank you, buddy. And obviously, a massive, massive, massive thanks to Stu for co-hosting this entire series with me. You've been an absolute joy to work with, buddy.
Gary, honestly, I can't tell you what a great time I've had, and B, this is certainly not meant in an arrogant way, but how easy it's been, because all I've done is just sit and listen to experts and then just throw in any question that I felt that I wanted answering at the time. It's just been like a general knowledge jukebox for football for me. I've just put my 50p in and asked a question and the answers popped out. It's been brilliant.
I'm glad you enjoyed it, buddy. Also, massive thanks to our earlier guests on the series. That's Dan, who talked to us about Chile and Argentina. James, who spoke to us about Turkey. Paul, our expert on Northern Irish football and Belfast Celtic. And Ryan, who spoke to us about Scottish football clubs and their identity. As Stu mentioned earlier, this is the final episode of Series 1 of The Political Football, but we'll be taking a break, and we're back in a few weeks with Series 2, and we'd really like you to come along and listen to us again. So thanks, and I hope you've enjoyed the series. Good night.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.